Hospital. Ho-hum department. Willie the agent, taking the cure in Hassan's hospital. Hassan's hospital adjoining cemetery. Cremations in the patio. Professional mourners solicit relatives in the waiting room and corridors. Disintoxication notes. Paranoia of early withdrawal. Everything looks blue. Flesh dead, doughy, toneless. Withdrawal nightmares. A mirror-lined cafe, empty, waiting for something. A man appears in a side door. A slight, short Arab dressed in a brown jalaba with gray beard and gray face. There is a pitcher of boiling acid in my hand. Seized by a convulsion of urgency, I throw it in his face. Everyone looks like a drug addict. Take a little walk in the hospital patio. In my absence, someone has used my scissors. They're stained with some sticky red-brown gick. No doubt that little bitch of a criada trimming her rag. Horrible-looking Europeans clutter up the stairs, intercept the nurse when I need my medicine, empty piss into the basin when I am washing, occupy the toilet for hours on end, probably fishing for a finger stall of diamonds they have stashed up their asshole. In fact, the whole clan of Europeans has moved in next to me. The old mother is having an operation, and her daughter move right in to see the old gash receive proper service. Strange visitors, presumably relatives. One of them wears as glasses those gadgets jewelers screw into their eyes to examine stones. Probably a diamond cutter on the skids. The man who loused up the Throckmorton diamond and was drummed out of the industry. All these jewelers standing around the diamond in their frock coats, waiting on the man. An error of 1/1000th of an inch ruins the rock complete, and they have to import this character special from Amsterdam to do the job. So he reels in dead drunk with a huge air hammer and pounds the diamond to dust. I don't check these citizens. Dope peddlers from Aleppo. Slunk traffickers from Buenos Aires. Illegal diamond buyers from Johannesburg, slave traders from Somaliland, collaborators at the very least. Continual dreams of junk. I'm looking for a poppy field. Moonshiners in black Stetsons direct me to a Near East cafe. One of the waiters is a connection for Yugoslav opium. Buy a packet of heroin from a Malay lesbian in white belted trench coat. I cop the paper in Tibetan section of a museum. She keeps trying to steal it back. I'm looking for a place to fix. The critical point of withdrawal is not the early phase of acute sickness, but the final step free from the medium of junk. There is a nightmare interlude of cellular panic, life suspended between two ways of being. At this point, the longing for junk concentrates in a last, all-out yin, and seems to gain a dream power. Circumstances put junk in your way. You meet an old-time schmecker, a larcenous hospital attendant, a writing croaker. A guard in a uniform of human skin, black buck jacket with carious yellow teeth buttons, an elastic pullover shirt in burnished Indian copper, adolescent Nordic suntanned slacks, sandals from calloused footsoles of young Malayan farmer, an ash-brown scarf knotted and tucked in the shirt. Ash-brown is a color like gray under brown skin. You sometimes find it in mixed Negro and white stock. The mixture did not come off, and the colors separated out like oil on water. The guard is a sharp dresser, since he has nothing to do and saves all his pay to buy fine clothes and changes 3 times a day in front of an enormous magnifying mirror. He has a Latin handsome smooth face with a pencil-lined mustache, small black eyes, blank and greedy, undreaming insect eyes. When I get to the frontier, the guard rushes out of his casita, a mirror in a wooden frame slung around his neck. He's trying to get the mirror off his neck. This has never happened before, that anyone reached the frontier. The guard has injured his larynx, taking off the mirror frame. He has lost his voice. He opens his mouth. You can see the tongue jumping around inside. The smooth, blank young face and the open mouth with the tongue moving inside are incredibly hideous. The guard holds up his hand. His whole body jerks in convulsive negation. I go over and unhook the chain across the road. It falls with a clank of metal on stone. I walk through. The guard stands there in the mist, looking after me. Then he hooks the chain up again, goes back into the casita, and starts plucking at his mustache. They just bring so-called lunch, a hard-boiled egg with the shell off, revealing an object like I never seen it before. A very small egg of a yellow-brown color, perhaps laid by the duck-billed platypus. The orange contained a huge worm and very little else. He really got there firstest with the mostest. In Egypt, as a worm gets into your kidneys and grows to an enormous size, ultimately the kidney is just a thin shell around the worm. Intrepid gourmets esteem the flesh of the worm above all other delicacies. It is said to be unspeakably toothsome. An interzone coroner known as Autopsy Ahmed made a fortune trafficking the worm. The French school is opposite my window, and I dig the boys with my 8-power field glasses, so close I could reach out and touch them. They wear shorts. I can see the goose pimples on their legs in the cold spring morning. I project myself out through the glasses and across the street, a ghost in the morning sunlight, torn with disembodied lust. Met Marv in front of the Sargasso with two Arab kids, and he said, "Want to watch these two kids screw each other?" "Of course. How much?" "I think they will perform for 50 cents. Hungry, you know. That's the way I like to see them. Makes me feel sort of like a dirty old man, but son cosas de la vida, as Sobrera de la Flor said when the fuzz upbraids him for blasting this cunt and taking the dead body to the Bar O Motel and fucking it. "She play hard to get already," he say. "I don't have to take that sound." Sobrera de la Flor was a Mexican criminal convicted of several rather pointless murders. The lavatory has been locked for 3 hours solid. I think they're using it for an operating room. Nurse: "I can't find her pulse, doctor." Dr. Benway:
"Maybe she got it up her snatch in a finger stall."
Nurse: "Adrenaline, doctor?" Dr. Benway:
"The night porter shot it all up for kicks."
He looks around and picks up one of those rubber vacuum cups at the end of a stick they use to unstop toilets. He advances on the patient.
"Make an incision, Dr. Lymph," he says to his appalled assistant. "I'm going to massage the heart."
Dr. Lymph shrugs and begins the incision. Dr. Benway washes the suction cup by swishing it around in the toilet bowl. Nurse:
"Shouldn't it be sterilized, doctor?"
Dr. Benway:
"Very likely, but there's no time."
He sits on the suction cup like a cane seat, watching his assistant make the incision.
"You young squirts couldn't lance a pimple without an electric vibrating scalpel with automatic drain and suture. Soon we'll be operating by remote control on patients we never see. We'll be nothing but button pushers. All the skill is going out of surgery. All the know-how and make-do. Did I ever tell you about the time I performed an appendectomy with a rusty sardine can? And once I was caught short without instrument one and removed a uterine tumor with my teeth. That was in the upper effendi. And besides..."
Dr. Lymph: "The incision is ready, doctor." Dr. Benway forces the cup into the incision and works it up and down. Blood spurts all over the doctors, the nurse, and the wall. The cup makes a horrible sucking sound. Nurse:
"I think she's gone, doctor."
Dr. Benway:
"Well, it's all in the day's work."
He walks across the room to a medicine cabinet.
"Some fucking drug addict has cut my cocaine with Santa Flush. Nurse, send the boy out to fill this RX on the double."
Dr. Benway is operating in an auditorium filled with students.
"Now, boys, you won't see this operation performed very often, and there's a reason for that. You see, it has absolutely no medical value. No one knows what the purpose of it originally was, or if it had a purpose at all. Personally, I think it was a pure artistic creation from the beginning. Just as a bullfighter with his skill and knowledge extricates himself from danger he has himself invoked. So in this operation, the surgeon deliberately endangers his patient and then, with incredible speed and celerity, rescues him from death at the last possible split second. Did any of you ever see Dr. Tetrazzini perform? I say perform advisedly because his operations were performances. He would start by throwing a scalpel across the room into the patient and then make his entrance like a ballet dancer. His speed was incredible. "I don't give them time to die," he would say. "Tumors put him in a frenzy of rage. Fucking undisciplined cells," he would snarl, advancing on the tumor like a knife fighter. A young man leaps down into the operating theater and, whipping out a scalpel, advances on the patient. Dr. Benway,
"An espontaneo! Stop him before he guts my patient!"
Espontaneo is a bullfighting term for a member of the audience who leaps down into the ring, pulls out a concealed cape, and attempts a few passes with the bull before he is dragged out of the ring. The orderlies scuffle with the espontaneo, who is finally ejected from the hall. The anesthetist takes advantage of the confusion to pry a large gold filling from the patient's mouth. I am passing room 10 they moved me out of yesterday. Maternity case, I assume. Bedpans full of blood and Kotex and nameless female substances, enough to pollute a continent. If someone comes to visit me in my old room, he will think I gave birth to a monster and the State Department is trying to hush it up. Music from I Am an American. An elderly man in the striped pants and cutaway of a diplomat stands on a platform draped with the American flag, a decayed, corseted tenor bursting out of a Daniel Boone costume is singing the Star-Spangled Banner, accompanied by a full orchestra. He sings with a slight lisp. The diplomat, reading from a great scroll of ticker tape that keeps growing and tangling around his feet.
"And we categorically deny that any male citizen of the United States of America..."
Tenor.
"Oh, say, can you see?"
His voice breaks and shoots up to a high falsetto. In the control room, the technician mixes a bicarbonate of soda and belches into his hand. "Goddamn tenor's a brown artist," he mutters sourly.
"Mike!"
"Humph!" The shout ends in a belch.
"Cut that swish fart off the air and give him his purple slip. He's through as of right now. Put in that sex change Liz athlete. She's a full-time tenor at least."
"Costume? How in the fuck should I know? I'm no dress designer swish from the costume department." "What's that?" "The entire costume department occluded as a security risk? What am I, an octopus? Let's see. How about an Indian routine? Pocahontas or Hiawatha? No, that's not right. Some citizen cracks wise about giving it back to the Indians. A Civil War uniform, the coat north and the pants south, like it show they got together again. She can come on like Buffalo Bill or Paul Revere, or that citizen wouldn't give up the shit. I mean the ship, or a GI or a doughboy or the unknown soldier. That's the best deal. Cover her with a monument. That way nobody has to look at her."
The lesbian, concealed in a papier-mâché Arc de Triomphe, fills her great lungs and looses a tremendous bellow.
"Oh, say do that star-spangled banner yet wave."
A great rent rips the Arc de Triomphe from top to bottom. The diplomat puts a hand to his forehead. The diplomat,
"That any male citizen of the United States has given birth in Interzone or at any other place,
or the land of the free..."
The diplomat's mouth is moving, but no one can hear him. The technician clasps his hands over his ears. "Mother of God!" he screams. His plate begins to vibrate like a Jew's harp, suddenly flies out of his mouth. He snaps at it irritably, misses, and covers his mouth with one hand. The Arc de Triomphe falls with a ripping, splintering crash, reveals the lesbian standing on a pedestal clad only in a leopard-skin jockstrap with enormous falsy basket. She stands there smiling stupidly and flexing her huge muscles. The technician is crawling around on the control room floor looking for his plate and shouting unintelligible orders.
The supersonic Fifth Earth off of there!
The diplomat, wiping sweat from his brow.
To any creature of any type or description,
and the home of the brave.
The diplomat's face is gray. He staggers, trips in the scroll, sags against the rail, blood pouring from eyes, nose, and mouth, dying of cerebral hemorrhage. The diplomat, barely audible.
The department denies un-American. It's been destroyed. I mean, it never was.
Dies. In the control room, instrument panels are blowing out. Great streamers of electricity crackle through the room. The technician, naked, his body burned black, staggers about like a figure in Götterdämmerung, screaming,
Supersonic! Off the fair!
A final blast reduces the technician to a cinder.
Gave proof through the night that our flag was still there.
Habit notes. Shooting Eukadol every 2 hours. I have a place where I can slip my needle right into a vein. It stays open like a red, festering mouth, swollen and obscene, gathers a slow drop of blood and pus after the shot. Eukadol is a chemical variation of codeine, dihydrooxycodeine. This stuff comes on more like C than M. When you shoot coke in the main line, there is a rush of pure pleasure to the head. 10 minutes later, you want another shot. The pleasure of morphine is in the viscera. You listen down into yourself after a shot. But intravenous C is electricity through the brain, activating cocaine pleasure connections. There is no withdrawal syndrome with C. It is a need of the brain alone, a need without body and without feeling. Earthbound ghost need. The craving for C lasts only a few hours as long as the C channels are stimulated. Then you forget it. Eukadol is like a combination of junk and C. Trust the Germans to concoct some really evil shit. Eukadol, like morphine, is 6 times stronger than codeine. Heroin, 6 times stronger than morphine. Dihydrooxyheroin should be 6 times stronger than heroin. Quite possible to develop a drug so habit-forming that one shot would cause lifelong addiction. Habit notes continued. Picking up needle, I reach spontaneously for the tie-up cord with my left hand. This I take as a sign I can hit the one usable vein in my left arm. The movements of tying up are such that you normally tie up the arm with which you reach for the cord. The needle slides in easily on the edge of a callus. I feel around. Suddenly a thin column of blood shoots up into the syringe, for a moment sharp and solid as a red cord. The body knows what veins you can hit, and conveys this knowledge in the spontaneous movements you make preparing to take a shot. Sometimes the needle points like a dowser's wand. Sometimes I must wait for the message, but when it comes I always hit blood. A red orchid bloomed at the bottom of the dropper. He hesitated for a full second, then pressed the bulb, watching the liquid rush into the vein as if sucked by the silent thirst of his blood. There was an iridescent, thin coat of blood left in the dropper, and the white paper collar was soaked through with blood like a bandage. He reached over and filled the dropper with water. As he squirted the water out, the shot hit him in the stomach, a soft, sweet blow. Look down at my filthy trousers, haven't been changed in months. The days glide by, strung on a syringe with a long thread of blood. I am forgetting sex and all sharp pleasures of the body, a gray, junk-bound ghost. The Spanish boys call me El Hombre Invisible, the Invisible Man. 20 push-ups every morning. Use of junk removes fat, leaves muscle more or less intact. The addict seems to need less tissue. Would it be possible to isolate the fat-removing molecule of junk? More and more static at the drugstore, mutterings of control like a telephone off the hook. Spent all day until 6 p.m. to score for 2 boxes of Eucadol. Running out of veins and out of money. Keep going on the nod. Last night I woke up with someone squeezing my hand. It was my other hand. Fall asleep reading, and the words take on code significance. Obsessed with codes. Man contracts a series of diseases which spell out a code message. Take a shot in front of DL, probing for a vein in my dirty bare foot. Junkies have no shame. They're impervious to the repugnance of others. It is doubtful if shame can exist in the absence of sexual libido. The junkie's shame disappears with his non-sexual sociability, which is also dependent on libido. The addict regards his body impersonally as an instrument to absorb the medium in which he lives, evaluates his tissue with the cold hands of a horse trader. No use trying to hit there. Dead fish eyes flick over a ravaged vein. Using a new type sleeping pill called Sonoril, you don't feel sleepy. You shift to sleep without transition, fall abruptly into the middle of a dream. I have been years in a prison camp suffering from malnutrition. The president is a junkie but can't take it direct because of his position, so he gets fixed through me. From time to time we make contact and I recharge him. These contacts look to the casual observer like homosexual practices, but the actual excitement is not primarily sexual, and the climax is the separation when the recharge is completed. The erect penises are brought into contact. At least we used that method in the beginning. But contact points wear out like veins. Now I sometimes have to slip my penis under his left eyelid. Of course, I can always fix him with an osmosis recharge, which corresponds to a skin shot. But that is admitting defeat. An O.R. will put the president in a bad mood for weeks and might well precipitate an atomic shambles. And the president pays a high price for the oblique habit. He has sacrificed all control and is dependent as an unborn child. The oblique addict suffers a whole spectrum of subjective horror, silent protoplasmic frenzy, hideous agony of the bones. Tensions build up. Pure energy without emotional content finally tears through the body, throwing him about like a man in contact with high-tension wires. If his charged connection is cut off cold, the oblique addict falls into such violent electric convulsions that his bones shake loose, and he dies with the skeleton straining to climb out of his unendurable flesh and run in a straight line to the nearest cemetery. The relation between an O.A., oblique addict, and his R.C., recharge connection, is so intense that they can only endure each other's company for brief and infrequent intervals, I mean aside from recharge meets, when all personal contact is eclipsed by the recharge process. Reading the paper, something about a triple murder in the Rue de la Merde, Paris. An adjusting of scores. I keep slipping away. The police have identified the author, Pepe El Culito, the little asshole, an affectionate diminutive. Does it really say that? I try to focus the words. They separate in meaningless mosaic.
Lazarus, go home. Fumbling through faded tape at the pickup frontier, a languid gray area of hiatus, miasmic with yawns and gaping goof holes, Lee found out that the young junkie standing there in his room at 10 a.m. was back from 2 months skin diving in Corsica and off the junk. Here to show off his new body, Lee decided with a shudder of morning junk sickness. He knew that he was seen. Ah, yes, Miguel, thank you. 3 months back, sitting in the Metropole, nodded out over a stale yellow eclair that would poison a cat 2 hours later. Decided that the effort involved in seeing Miguel at all at 10 a.m. was enough without the intolerable chore of correcting an error. What is this, a fucking farm? Which would also entail current picture of Miguel in much used areas like some great inconvenient beast of an object on top in the suitcase. You look marvelous, Lee said, wiping away the more obvious signs of distaste with a sloppy, casual napkin, seeing the gray ooze of junk in Miguel's face, studying patterns of shabbiness as if man and clothes had moved for years through back alleys of time with never a space station to tidy up. Besides, by the time I could correct the error, Lazarus, go home. Pay the man and go home. What I want to see your old borrowed meat for? Well, it's great to see you off. Do yourself a favor. Miguel was swimming around the room, spearing fish with his hand. When you're down there, you never think about horse. You're better off like this, said Lee, dreamily caressing a needle scar on the back of Miguel's hand, following the whorls and patterns of smooth purple flesh in a slow, twisting movement. Miguel scratched the back of his hand. He looked out the window. His body moved in little galvanized jerks as junk channels lit up. Lee sat there waiting. One snort never put any back on, kid. I know what I'm doing. They always know. Miguel took the nail file. Lee closed his eyes. It's too tiresome. Thanks, that was great. Miguel's pants fell to his ankles. He stood there in a misshapen overcoat of flesh that turned from brown to green and then colorless in the morning light, fell off in globs onto the floor. Lee's eyes moved in the substance of his face, a little cold gray flick. Clean it up, he said. Enough dirt in here now. Sure, Miguel fumbled with a dustpan. Lee put the packet of heroin away. Lee lived in a permanent third-day kick, with, of course, certain essential intermissions to refuel the fires that burned through his yellow-pink-brown gelatinous substance and kept off the hovering flesh. In the beginning, his flesh was simply soft, so soft that he was cut to the bone by dust particles, air currents, and brushing overcoats, while direct contact with doors and chairs seemed to occasion no discomfort. No wound healed in his soft, tentative flesh. Long white tendrils of fungus curled round the naked bones. Mold odors of atrophied testicles quilted his body in a fuzzy gray fog. During his first severe infection, the boiling thermometer flashed a quicksilver bullet into the nurse's brain, and she fell dead with a mangled scream. The doctor took one look and slammed steel shutters of survival. He ordered the burning bed and its occupant immediately evicted from the hospital premises.
"Guess he can make his own penicillin," snarled the doctor.
But the infection burned the mold out. Lee lived now in varying degrees of transparency. While not exactly invisible, he was at least difficult to see. His presence attracted no special notice. People covered him with a project or dismissed him as a reflection, shadow, some kind of light trick or neon advertisement. Now Lee felt the first seismic tremors of Old Faithful, the cold burn. He pushed Miguel's spirit into the hall with a kind, firm tendril.
"Jesus," said Miguel. "I gotta go."
He rushed out. Pink fires of histamine spurted from Lee's glowing core and covered his raw periphery. The room was fireproof, the walls of iron blistered and spotted with moon craters. He took a large fix and falsified his schedule. He decided to visit a colleague, N.G. Joe, who got hooked during a Bangutat attack in Honolulu. Note, Bangutat, literally, attempting to get up and groaning, death occurring in the course of a nightmare. The condition occurs in males of Southeast Asiatic extraction. In Manila, about 12 cases of death by Bangutat are recorded each year. Victims often know that they are going to die, express the fear that their penis will enter the body and kill them. Sometimes they cling to the penis in a state of shrieking hysteria, calling on others for help lest the penis escape and pierce the body. Erections such as normally occur in sleep are considered especially dangerous and liable to bring a fatal attack. One man devised a Rube Goldberg contraption to prevent erection during sleep, but he died of Bangutat. Careful autopsies of Bangutat victims have revealed no organic reason for death. There are often signs of strangulation. Caused by what? Sometimes slight hemorrhages of pancreas and lungs, not sufficient to cause death, and also of unknown origin. It has occurred to the author that the cause of death is a misplacement of sexual energy, resulting in a lung erection, with consequent strangulation. One man who recovered said that a little man was sitting on his chest and strangling him. See article by Niels Larsen, M.D., The Men with the Deadly Dream, in the Saturday Evening Post, December 3, 1955, also article by Earl Stanley Gardner for True magazine. N.G. lived in constant fear of erection, so his habit jumped and jumped. Note, it is a well-known tiresome fact, it is a notoriously dull and long-winded fact, that anyone who gets hooked because of any disability whatever will be presented during the periods of shortage or deprivation, such a thing as too much fun, you know, with an outrageously padded, geometrically progressing, proliferating account. An electrode attached to one testicle glowed briefly, and NG woke up in the smell of burning flesh and reached for a loaded syringe. He rolled into a fetal position and slid the needle into his spine. He pulled the needle out with a little sigh of pleasure and realized that Lee was in the room. A long slug undulated out of Lee's right eye and wrote on the wall in iridescent ooze, "The sailor is in the city buying up time." I am waiting in front of a drugstore for it to open at 9 o'clock. Two Arab boys roll cans of garbage up to a high, heavy wood door in a whitewashed wall, dust in front of the door streaked with urine. One of the boys bent over, rolling the heavy cans, pants tight over his lean young ass. He looks at me with the neutral, calm glance of an animal. I wake with a shock like the boys reel, and I have missed a meet I had with him for this afternoon. "We expect additional equalizations," says the inspector in an interview with your reporter. "Otherwise will occur," the inspector lifts one leg in a typical Nordic gesture, "the bends, is it not? But perhaps we can provide the suitable chamber of decompression." The inspector opens his fly and begins looking for crabs, applying ointment from a little clay pot. Clearly the interview is at an end. "You're not going," he exclaims. "Well, as one judge said to the other, be just, and if you can't be just, be arbitrary. Regret cannot observe customary obscenities." He holds up his right hand, covered with a foul-smelling yellow ointment. One's reporter rushes forward and clasps the soiled hand in both of his. "It's been a pleasure, Inspector, an unspeakable pleasure," he says, peeling off his gloves, rolling them into a ball and tossing them into the wastebasket. "Expense account," he smiles. Hassan's rumpus room. Gilt and red plush. Rococo bar backed by pink shell. The air is cloyed with a sweet, evil substance like decayed honey. Men and women in evening dress sip pousse cafés through alabaster tubes. A Near East mugwump sits naked on a bar stool covered in pink silk. He licks warm honey from a crystal goblet with a long black tongue. His genitals are perfectly formed, circumcised cock, black shiny pubic hairs. His lips are thin and purple-blue like the lips of a penis, his eyes blank with insect calm. The mugwump has no liver, maintaining himself exclusively on sweets. The mugwump pushes a slender blonde youth to a couch and strips him expertly.
"Stand up and turn around,"
he orders in telepathic pictographs. He ties the boy's hands behind him with a red silk cord.
"Tonight we make it all the way."
"No, no," screams the boy.
"Yes, yes."
Cocks ejaculate in silent
yes.
The mugwump parts silk curtains, reveals a teak wood gallows against lighted screen of red flint. Gallows is on a dais of Aztec mosaics. The boy crumples to his knees with a long, "Oh!" shitting and pissing in terror. He feels the shit warm between his thighs. A great wave of hot blood swells his lips and throat. His body contracts into a fetal position and sperm spurts hot into his face. The mugwump dips hot, perfumed water from alabaster bowl, pensively washes the boy's ass and cock, drying him with a soft blue towel. A warm wind plays over the boy's body, and the hairs float free. The mugwump puts a hand under the boy's chest and pulls him to his feet, holding him by both pinioned elbows, propels him up the steps and under the noose. He stands in front of the boy, holding the noose in both hands. The boy looks into mugwump eyes, blank as obsidian mirrors, pools of black blood, glory holes in a toilet wall closing on the last erection. An old garbage collector, face fine and yellow as Chinese ivory, blows the blast on his dented brass horn, wakes the Spanish pimp with a hard-on. Whore staggers out through dust and shit and litter of dead kittens, carrying bales of aborted fetuses, broken condoms, bloody Kotex, shit wrapped in bright color comics. A vast, still harbor of iridescent water. Deserted gas well flares on the smoky horizon, stink of oil and sewage. Sick sharks swim through the black water, belch sulfur from rotting livers, ignore a bloody, broken Icarus. Naked Mr. America, burning, frantic with self-bone love, screams out, "My asshole confounds the Louvre! I fart ambrosia and shit pure gold turds! My cock spurts soft diamonds in the morning sunlight!" He plummets from the eyeless lighthouse, kissing and jacking off in face of the black mirror, glides obliquely down with cryptic condoms and mosaic of a thousand newspapers through a drowned city of red brick to settle in black mud with tin cans and beer bottles, gangsters in concrete, pistols pounded flat and meaningless to avoid short-arm inspection of prurient ballistic experts. He waits the slow striptease of erosion with fossil loins. The mugwump slips the noose over the boy's head and tightens the knot caressingly behind the left ear. The boy's penis is retracted, his balls tight. He looks straight ahead, breathing deeply. The mugwump sidles around the boy, goosing him and caressing his genitals in hieroglyphs of mockery. He moves in behind the boy with a series of bumps and shoves his cock up the boy's ass. He stands there, moving in circular gyrations. The guests shush each other, nudge and giggle. Suddenly the mugwump pushes the boy forward into space, free of his cock. He steadies the boy with hands on the hip bones, reaches up with his stylized hieroglyph hands and snaps the boy's neck. A shudder passes through the boy's body. His penis rises in three great surges, pulling his pelvis up, ejaculates immediately. Green sparks explode behind his eyes. A sweet toothache pain shoots through his neck, down the spine to the groin, contracting the body in spasms of delight. His whole body squeezes out through his cock. A final spasm throws a great spurt of sperm across the red screen like a shooting star.
The boy falls with soft, gutty suction through a maze of penny arcades and dirty pictures. A sharp turd shoots clean out of his ass. Farts shake his slender body. Skyrockets burst in green clusters across a great river. He hears the faint putt-putt of a motorboat in jungle twilight, under silent wings of the Anopheles mosquito. The mugwump pulls the boy back onto his cock. The boy squirms, impaled like a speared fish. The mugwump swings on the boy's back, his body contracting in fluid waves. Blood flows down the boy's chin from his mouth, half open, sweet and sulky in death. The mugwump falls with a fluid, sated plop. Windowless cubicle with blue walls. Dirty pink curtain cover the door. Red bugs crawl on the wall, cluster in corners. Naked boy in the middle of the room, twang a two-string oud, trace an arabesque on the floor. Another boy lean back on the bed, smoking keef and blow smoke over his erect cock. They play game with tarot cards on the bed to see who fuck who. Cheat. Fight. Roll on the floor, snarling and spitting like young animals. The loser sit on the floor, chin on knees, licks a broken tooth. The winner curls up on the bed, pretending to sleep. Whenever the other boy come near, kick at him. Ali seize him by one ankle, tuck the ankle under his armpit, lock his arm around the calf. The boy kick desperately at Ali's face, another ankle pinioned. Ali tilt the boy back on his shoulders. The boy's cock extends along his stomach, float free, pulsing. Ali put his hands behind the boy's knees, push his legs over his head, spit on his cock. The other sighs deeply as Ali slides his cock in. The mouths grind together, smearing blood, sharp, musty odor of penetrated rectum. Neiman drive in like a wedge, force jism out the other cock in long, hot spurts. The author has observed that Arab cocks tend to be wide and wedge-shaped. Satyr and naked Greek lad in aqualungs trace a ballet of pursuit in a monster vase of transparent alabaster. The satyr catches the boy from in front and whirls him around. They move in fish jerks. The boy releases a silver stream of bubbles from his mouth. White sperm ejaculates into the green water and floats lazily around the twisting bodies. Negro gently lifts exquisite Chinese boy into a hammock. He pushes the boy's legs up over his head and straddles the hammock. He slides his cock up the boy's slender, tight ass. He rocks the hammock gently back and forth. The boy screams a weird, high wail of unendurable delight. A Javanese dancer in ornate teak swivel chair set in a socket of limestone buttocks pulls an American boy, red hair, bright green eyes, down onto his cock with ritual motions. The boy sits impaled, facing the dancer who propels himself in circular gyrations, lending fluid substance to the chair. "Whee!" screams the boy as his sperm spurts up over the dancer's lean brown chest. One gob hits the corner of the dancer's mouth. The boy pushes it in with his finger and laughs.
"Man, that's what I call suction."
Two Arab women with bestial faces have pulled the shorts off a little blonde French boy. They are screwing him with red rubber cocks. The boy snarls, bites, kicks, collapses in tears as his cock rises and ejaculates. Hassan's face swells tumescent with blood. His lips turn purple. He strips off his suit of banknotes and throws it into an open vault that closes soundless.
"Freedom Hall here, folks," he screams in his phony Texas accent.
10-gallon hat and cowboy boots still on, he dances the liquefactionist jig, ending with a grotesque can-can to the tune of "She Started a Heat Wave."
"Let it be, and no holes barred."
Couples attached to Baroque harnesses with artificial wings copulate in the air, screaming like magpies. Aerialists ejaculate each other in space with one sure touch.
Equilibrists suck each other off deftly, balanced on perilous poles and chairs tilted over the void. A warm wind brings the smell of rivers and jungle from misty depths. Boys by the hundred plummet through the roof, quivering and kicking at the end of ropes. The boys hang at different levels, some near the ceiling and others a few inches off the floor. Exquisite Balinese and Malays, Mexican Indians with fierce, innocent faces and bright red gums, Negroes, teeth, fingers, toenails, and pubic hair gilded. Japanese boys, smooth and white as China, Titian-haired Venetian lads, Americans with blonde or black curls falling across the forehead. The guests tenderly shove it back. Sulky blonde Polacks with animal brown eyes, Arab and Spanish street boys, Austrian boys, pink and delicate with a faint shadow of blonde pubic hair, sneering German youths with bright blue eyes scream, "Heil Hitler!" as the trap falls under them. Salubis shit and whimper. Mr. Rich and Vulgar chews his Havana, lewd and nasty, sprawled on a Florida beach surrounded by simpering blonde catamites.
"This citizen have a latte he import from Indochina. He figures to hang the latte and send a Xmas TV short to his friends. So he fix up two ropes, one gimmick to stretch, the other the real McCoy. But that latte gets up in feud state and puts on his Santa Claus suit and make with the switcheroo. Come the dawning. The citizen puts one rope on, and the latte, going along the way lattes will, puts on the other. When the traps are down, the citizen hangs for real, and the latte stand with the carny rubber stretch rope. Well, the latte imitate every twitch and spasm. Come three times. Smart young latte keep his eye on the ball. I got him working in one of my plants as an expediter."
Aztec priests strip blue feather robe from the naked youth. They bend him back over a limestone altar. Fit a crystal skull over his head, securing the two hemispheres back and front with crystal screws. A waterfall pours over the skull, snapping the boy's neck. He ejaculates in a rainbow against the rising sun. Sharp protein odor of semen fills the air. The guests run hands over twitching boys, suck their cocks, hang on their backs like vampires. Naked lifeguards carry in iron lungs full of paralyzed youths. Blind boys grope out of huge pies. Deteriorated schizophrenics pop from a rubber cunt. Boys with horrible skin diseases rise from a black pond. Sluggish fish nibble yellow turds on the surface. A man with white tie and dress shirt, naked from the waist down except for black garters, talks to the queen bee in elegant tones. Queen bees are old women who surround themselves with fairies to form a swarm. It is a sinister Mexican practice.
"But where is the statuary?"
He talks out of one side of his face. The other is twisted by the torture of a million mirrors. He masturbates wildly. The queen bee continues the conversation, notices nothing. Couches, chairs, the whole floor begins to vibrate, shaking the guests to blurred gray ghosts shrieking in cock-bound agony. Two boys jacking off under railroad bridge. The train shakes through their bodies, ejaculates them, fades with a distant whistle. Frogs croak. The boys wash semen off lean brown stomachs. Train compartment. Two sick young junkies on their way to Lexington tear their pants down in convulsions of lust. One of them soaps his cock and works it up the other's ass with a corkscrew motion.
"Jesus!"
Both ejaculate at once, standing up. They move away from each other and pull up their pants. Old Croker in Marshall writes for tincture and sweet oil. The piles of an aged mother shriek out, raw and bleeding, for the black shit. "Doc, suppose it was your mother, rimmed by resident leeches, squirming around so nasty. Deactive that pelvis, Mom, you disgust me already."
Let's stop over and make him for an RX.
The train tears on through the smoky, neon-lighted June night. Pictures of men and women, boys and girls, animals, fish, birds. The copulating rhythm of the universe flows through the room. A great blue tide of life, vibrating, soundless hum of deep forest, sudden quiet of cities when the junkie cops. A moment of stillness and wonder. Even the commuter buzzes clogged lines of cholesterol for contact. Hassan shrieks out,
"This is your doing, AJ! You poop on my party!"
AJ looks at him, face remote as limestone.
"Up of your ass, you liquefying gook!"
A horde of lust-mad American women rush in, dripping cunts from farm and dude ranch, factory, brothel, country club, penthouse and suburb, motel and yacht and cocktail bar, strip-off riding clothes, ski togs, evening dresses, Levi's, tea gowns, print dresses, slacks, bathing suits, and kimonos. They scream and yip and howl, leap on the guests like bitch dogs in heat with rabies. They claw at the hanged boys, shrieking,
"You fairy, you bastard, fuck me, fuck me, fuck me."
The guests flee screaming, dodge among the hanged boys, overturn iron lungs. AJ,
"Call out my Switzers, goddammit, guard me from these she-foxes."
Mr. Hislop, AJ's secretary, looks up from his comic book.
"The Switzers liquefy already."
Liquefaction involves protein cleavage and reduction to liquid which is absorbed into someone else's protoplasmic being. Hassan, a notorious liquefactionist, is probably the beneficiary in this case. AJ,
"Gold-bricking cocksuckers! Where's a man without his Switzers? Our backs are to the wall, gentlemen, our very cocks at stake. Stand by to resist borders, Mr. Hislop, and issue short arms to the men."
AJ whips out a cutlass and begins decapitating the American girls. He sings lustily,
15 men on a dead man's chest, yo ho ho, and a bottle of rum. Drink and the devil had done for the rest, yo ho ho, and a bottle of rum.
Mr. Hislop, bored and resigned,
"Oh God, he's at it again."
He waves the Jolly Roger listlessly. AJ, surrounded and fighting against overwhelming odds, throws back his head and makes with the hog call. Immediately 1,000 rutting Eskimos pour in, grunting and squealing, faces tumescent, eyes hot and red, lips purple, fall on the American women. Eskimos have a rutting season when the tribes meet in short summer to disport themselves in orgies. Their faces swell and lips turn purple. A house dick with cigar 2 feet long sticks his head in through the wall.
"Have you got a menagerie in here?"
Hassan wrings his hands.
"A shambles, a filthy shambles! My Allah, I never see anything so downright nasty."
He whirls on AJ, who is sitting on a sea chest, parrot on shoulder, patch over one eye, drinking rum from a tankard. He scans the horizon with a huge brass telescope. Hassan,
"You cheap factualist bitch, go and never darken my rumpus room again."
Campus of Interzone University. Donkeys, camels, llamas, rickshaws, carts of merchandise pushed by straining boys, eyes protruding like strangled tongues, throbbing red with animal hate. Herds of sheep and goats and longhorn cattle pass between the students and the lecture platform. The students sit around on rusty park benches, limestone blocks, outhouse seats, packing crates, oil drums, stumps, dusty leather hassocks, moldy gym mats. They wear Levi's, jalabas, hose and doublet, drink corn from mason jars, coffee from tin cans, smoke gauge, marijuana, in cigarettes made of wrapping paper and lottery tickets, shoot junk with a safety pin and dropper, study racing forms, comic books, Mayan codices.
The professor arrives on a bicycle carrying a string of bullheads. He mounts the platform holding his back. Crane swings a bellowing cow over his head. Prof.
Fucked by the Sultan's army last night. I have dislocate the back in the service of my resident queen. Can't evict that old gash. Need a licensed brain electrician, disconnect her synapse by synapse, and a surgical bailiff put her guts out on the sidewalk. When Ma move in on a boy bagging baggage, he play hell dispossess that gold star border.
He looks at the bullheads, humming tunes from the 1920s.
The nostalgia fit is on me, boys, and will out, willy-silly. Boys walk down the carny midway, eating pink spun sugar, goose each other at the peep show, jack off in the Ferris wheel, throw sperm at the moon rising red and smoky over the foundries across the river. A nigra hangs from a cottonwood in front of the old courthouse. Whimpering women catch his sperm in vaginal teeth.
Husband looks at the little changeling with narrow eyes the color of a faded gray flannel shirt.
Doc, I suspect it to be a nigra.
The doctor shrugs. It's the old army game, son. Pee under the shell. Now you see it, now you don't.
And Doc Parker in the back room in his drugstore, shooting horse heroin, 3 grains a jolt. Tonic, he mutters. It's always spring. Hans Benson, town pervert, has took up a querencia in the school privy. Querencia is a bullfight term. The bull will find a spot in the ring he likes and stay there, and the bullfighter has to go in and meet the bull on his bull terms or coax him out, one or the other. Sheriff A.Q. Flat Larson say,
"Some way we gotta lure him out of that querencia."
And old Ma Lottie sleep 10 years with a dead daughter and home cured, too, wakes shivering in the East Texas dawn. Vultures out over the black swamp water and cypress stumps. And now, gentlemen, I trust there are no transvestites present. And you are all gentlemen by act of Congress, it being only remain to establish you male humans. Positively no transitionals in either direction will be allowed in this decent hall. Gentlemen, present short arms. Now you have all been briefed on the importance of keeping your weapons well lubricated and ready for any action, flank or rear guard.
Students,
hear, hear!
They wearily unbutton their flies. One of them brandishes a huge erection.
Prof. And now, gentlemen, where was I? Oh, yes, Ma Lottie. She wakes shivering in the gentle pink dawn, pink as the candles on a little girl's birthday cake, pink as spun sugar, pink as a seashell, pink as a cock pulsing in a red fucking light. Ma Lottie. Arumph. If this prolixity be not cut short, we'll succumb to the infirmities of age and join her daughter in formaldehyde. The rhyme of the Ancient Mariner by Coleridge, the poet. I should like to call your attention to the symbolism of the Ancient Mariner himself.
Students.
Himself, the man says. Thereby call attention to his own unappetizing person.
That wasn't a nice thing to do, teach. 100 juvenile delinquents, switchblades clicking like teeth, move at him.
Prof. Oh, land sakes!
He tries desperately to disguise himself as an old woman with high black shoes and umbrella.
If it wasn't for my lumbago, can't rightly bend over, I'd turn to them offering my sugar bum the way baboons do it. If a weaker baboon be attacked by a stronger baboon, the weaker baboon will either A, present his rump fanny, I believe is the word, gentlemen, for passive intercourse, or B, if he is a different type baboon, more extrovert and well-adjusted, lead an attack on an even weaker baboon if he can find one.
Dilapidated Deezers in 1920 clothes like she sleep in them ever since. Undulates across dreary, neon-lighted Chicago street, dead weight of the dear dead days hanging in the air like an earthbound ghost. Deezer's canned heat tenor.
Find the weakest baboon.
Frontier saloon. Fag baboon dressed in little girl blue dress sings in resigned voice to tune of Alice Blue Gown. I'm the weakest baboon of them all. A freight train separates the prof from the juveniles. When the train passes, they have fat stomachs and responsible jobs. Students, we want Lottie! Prof, that was in another country, gentlemen. As I was saying before, I was so rudely interrupted by one of my multiple personalities. Troublesome little beasts. Consider the ancient mariner without curare, lasso, bobo capnine, or straitjacket, albeit able to capture and hold a live audience. What is his gimmick? He does not like so-called artists at this time stop just anybody, thereby inflicting unsent-for boredom and working random hardship. He stops those who cannot choose but hear, owing to already existing relation between the mariner, however ancient, and the wedding guest. What the mariner actually says is not important. He may be rambling, irrelevant, even crude and rampant senile, but something happens to the wedding guest like happens in psychoanalysis when it happens, if it happens. If I may be permitted a slight digression, an analyst of my acquaintance does all the talking. Patients listen, patiently or not. He reminisces, tells dirty jokes, old ones, achieves counterpoints of idiocy undreamed of by the county clerk. He is illustrating at some length that nothing can ever be accomplished on the verbal level. He arrived at this method through observing that the listener, the analyst, was not reading the mind of the patient. The patient, the talker, was reading his mind. That is, the patient has ESP awareness of the analyst's dreams and schemes, whereas the analyst contacts the patient strictly from front brain. Many agents use this approach. They are notoriously long-winded bores and bad listeners. Gentlemen, I will slop a pearl. You can find out more about someone by talking than by listening.
Pigs rush up, and the prof pours buckets of pearls into a trough.
I am not worthy to eat his feet, says the fattest hog of them all. Clay, anywho.